Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Okay, we know it's the fighting season in Afghanistan. Summertime, snow's melted, guns ready to go. Still, almost 7 years after the U.S. invasion, the headlines in the last couple of weeks have been arresting. A 1,000-man jailbreak, including lots of Taliban fighters in Kandahar. Combat in the south and east, civilians dying and foreign soldiers, more last month than in Iraq. NATO's asking for 6,000 more troops fast to avoid losing ground. Congress is voting more billions. This hour on Point, the war in Afghanistan gets hot nearly 7 years in. Joining me first today from Kabul, Afghanistan, is John Boone, Afghanistan correspondent for the Financial Times. Last week, he was embedded with Canadian forces in southern Kandahar province as NATO and Afghan troops launched a major push against rallying Taliban fighters. John Boone, thank you very much for being with us.
No, it's always good to be here.
So first, what is the situation in the south? There, it seemed like we might have a full-blown uprising underway, then lots of Afghan troops and NATO troops sent south and things quieter again. What's going on now?
I think it's a bit much to say a full-blown uprising, but certainly, as you say, the Afghan National Army has been pouring troops into the south, and indeed ISAF, the international coalition, the US-led coalition, has been redeploying troops around the south. That seems to have had an effect. They went in the middle of last week to try and successfully put down a threat to Kandahar City, Afghanistan's second largest city and a sort of Taliban heartland, the sort of capital of the Taliban, Taliban Afghanistan. That seems to have worked. I've been away from Kandahar for a few days now, but the reports are that there's been a lot of violence over the last few days, but that the immediate threat to Kandahar has been dispensed with. That said, roadside blasts in four different provinces across the south and east over the last few days, just this weekend, have killed five coalition troops and five Afghan soldiers since Saturday. So it's been an extremely violent three to four days in the south of Afghanistan.
And now, John, the call going out urgently for 6,000 more NATO troops to get into Afghanistan to hold on to the ground that's been taken there. What's the cause for the urgency behind that request?
Well, I think commanders and sort of military tacticians have been saying this for a long time. Indeed, the outgoing American general who was in charge of international forces said only the other week that this is an under-resourced war. He also pointed out that U.S. counterinsurgency doctrine would dictate that there really needs to be about 400,000 troops in Afghanistan as opposed to the sort of 80,000 or so we have now. So I suspect the events of recent days have sort of focused minds, particularly as the province that was really in the news last week, which is Kandahar province. As I said, it's a critical one because it's so important to the sort of Taliban idea of Afghanistan. Security went south very rapidly following that jailbreak you mentioned, which happened Saturday before last. And the Canadians, who are the lead nation in that province, will frankly admit that they are overstretched. They've got under 3,000 troops, and of course, very few of them are actually involved in frontline fighting. Many of them are doing the sort of logistical backup work. So I think this latest call to 6,000 troops is actually far less than what many international sort of military think tank type people would want. And the fact that they're calling for it now goes along with what we've seen over the last few months in terms of people calling for more troops.
John, you were embedded with Canadian troops in the south. What happened in this jailbreak? It's been called, I've heard it called, the biggest jailbreak in history. It was certainly very large. 1,000-plus men got out of jail, including hundreds of Taliban fighters. It was, I believe, that prison was guarded by Canadian soldiers. What happened?
Well, I'm not sure there were Canadian soldiers actually guarding the prison, but certainly Canada has the lead responsibility for security in Kandahar. It was clearly a sort of well-executed, well-thought-out operation. Taliban insurgents, in a very large truck bomb, blew away a side of the jail, which allowed for all these prisoners, which included the estimates I've seen, about 400 to 450 hardened Taliban, to escape and sort of melt away. There were some people were caught, some people were killed. I'm told they were more the foreign fighters from Pakistan who perhaps didn't know the terrain so well, but certainly an extremely large number of hardened fighters were able to go back into circulation. I don't know if it was the biggest jailbreak in history, but it was certainly a deep embarrassment to the Afghan government and to international forces here who describe it as a, quote, spectacular, it's generally assumed the Taliban will try and follow this up with more spectaculars.
We read that the Taliban had minibuses waiting to whisk away escaped prisoners once the jailbreak took place. You've been with the Canadians. How's their morale? How was the fighting that you saw going during the days you were with him, John?
Well, the fighting I saw was interesting because we're told time and time again that the insurgents have moved away from going toe-to-toe with international forces and preferring to sort of disrupt and harass them with sort of roadside bombs and suicide attacks. But when I was in Zari district, which is really not far from either Kandahar City or Argandab, the district in the north of the city, which was the center of the storm last week, Taliban fighters, it's unclear how many were involved. It could have been between sort of 15 and 30, initiated an ambush on the troops that I was with and seemed very content to have a sort of blazing hour-long firefight. In terms of the morale of the Canadian troops, the particular ones I were with seemed to be enjoying it heartily. It was their first contact that they had seen since they arrived in February. And some of the younger Canadians, it was their first sort of live battle that they'd ever fought. And they seemed to enjoy it a great deal, even though one of their colleagues had to be taken away by helicopter after being injured by a grenade.
High spirits there, but 7 years is a long time, and nobody wants to be doing that forever. John Boone with Financial Times, just back from Kandahar, joining us today from Kabul. Thanks very much for being with us, John.
Not at all.
Joining me now from Kabul is Joanna Nathan. She's a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group based in Afghanistan for the past 3 years. Joanna, thank you very much for being with us.
Just quite all right, Tom.
We're trying to get a fix on what's going on in that sprawling country. Lots of headlines out of the south and east in recent days and weeks. Talk of, some equivalent to the Tet Offensive in this jailbreak and the immediate aftermath. That seems to have settled down. Is this fighting season hotter than in previous years? Is it surprising, Joanna, how hot it is, given that it's been nearly 7 years since U.S. forces went in?
I think it is important to emphasize that it is a sprawling country, that in different parts of the country, things are obviously very different. Life in Kabul goes on as normal. I think what happened in Kandahar was an enormous shock. And that was largely what it was about, as a psychological blow, both to the government and foreign forces, and a morale boost for the Taliban. And as John was saying before me, I think they will do more of these spectaculars. We saw this previously with the recent attack on the military parade with Karzai there that got headlines. These are attacks that seize headlines around the world that are well coordinated, well planned, but ultimately do not take many people. This is what guerrillas do. On the whole question of 7 years on, I think it's vital to emphasise that so much of this goes to the way that the international intervention was designed at the very start. That back in 2001, we chose to put very few international feet on the ground then. Instead, we co-opted some very discredited leaders from past eras. At that time, in 2002, 2003, Crisis Group was calling for 20 or 30,000 peacekeepers out in the regions. Instead, they had 4,000 all in Kabul and gave many of these areas virtually, basically just co-opted the leaders, many of who were the very same people that the population so hated, that like the Taliban the first time around. We also failed to tackle what was happening in Pakistan. So again, the Taliban were able to flee across the border and regroup and re-strategize pretty much in peace. So we left all the conditions in place, really, for what has developed today. Didn't get to the root of the conflict then.
We're going to hear about strategy. We're going to hear a critic who says the so-called good war in Afghanistan is maybe not so good, not going so well. But at this moment, you know, in these days and weeks, in this fighting season, can the NATO troops claim progress, or has there been actually lost ground? It's hard to interpret from a distance, Joanna.
I think this year there are more incidents than ever before, and we've steadily watched this over, you know, the last few years, and finally the international community seems to be waking up to this. This was always sort of sold to us as, oh, it's all going fine there. And as I say, this is to anyone on the ground, this has been, you know, you can see this happening year by year. And we just really hope now that everybody is waking up to the seriousness of this and gets, you know, serious about tackling it. You know, there are more troops and more resources here than ever before. I think, you know, that Afghanistan's not going to be immediately abandoned, but still people have got to make sure that those troops and that money is being used in the best way. Mm. It's not just about simply pouring in more resources.
Joanna Nathan in Kabul, please stand by. More troops, more resources, more trouble in Afghanistan. We're trying to sort it out. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Gunfire there last week in southern Afghanistan. You can hear maybe the breathing there of Canadian troops taking it and returning it. We're talking about the state of war and peace in Afghanistan after a stretch of jailbreak and hot clashes in the south and east. We've been joined from Kabul in Afghanistan by Joanna Nathan, senior analyst there for the International Crisis Group. We'll be joined in a few minutes from London by Tariq Ali. He's been writing lately that the good war in Afghanistan is a mirage, his view. Certainly, it is nothing like wrapped up. We're joined right now from Monterey, California by John Arquilla, professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, specializes in unconventional warfare and terrorism. He's author of Worst Enemy, The Reluctant Transformation of the American Military. John Arquilla, it's been a few years. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you again.
Joanna Nathan in Kabul has just been pointing to strategy from the outset, saying there weren't enough troops there, and that was trouble then and maybe trouble now. But what's your sense of how things stand in Afghanistan today? Has progress been made toward the goal, and what is the goal at this point?
Well, I think we've had a few steps back this spring. There have always been offensives as the weather has broken, and it's a little more intense this year. I think in part the reason for this is a combination of factors. One, we have worn out our welcome to a great extent with many of the people of Afghanistan. I think the overuse of air power, what they call Big Daddy over there, has caused a lot of collateral damage and resentment. The Taliban have taken advantage of this, and they've even softened their image. Remember, these guys didn't even like television, and now they've got propaganda films of their own. Mm-hmm. So they're doing a good job marketing themselves. And then I think there's perhaps another reason behind the scale of operations, which is that as things have gotten so much better in Iraq, it could be that al-Qaeda has convinced its Taliban allies that maybe an offensive on larger scale in Afghanistan will take some of the pressure off of Iraq and, in fact, lead to the diversion of resources. And I think that we don't need more troops. in Afghanistan. We need to use them in smarter ways. In fact, some of the ways we pioneered in Iraq, which is having a network of small outposts and a lot more negotiations with tribal leaders, what I call the outpost and outreach, which we talked about a few years ago,
yes,
has worked extremely well in Iraq, and something like it could work in Afghanistan. But I think step number one is to rely a lot less on air power and a lot more on the good soldierly qualities of our troops. There was just an ambush last night, and 55 Taliban were killed to virtually no casualties for the ISAF forces.
Joanna Nathan, in Kabul, take us back to what happened in the last week or 10 days after we saw things heat up in the south. We saw Afghan troops rushed down there, NATO troops also, a lot of that air power cover from NATO forces, Big Daddy, as John Arquilla says, and this was in a difficult area where the Soviets had previously been tied down. Describe that area for us around Argandab and how things turned out last week. How did the counterpunch from NATO and Afghan forces go?
Well, I mean, as I explained to your producers, I have not been down there since the fighting. The last time I was down there in March, the last time I was able to travel to Argandab was November last year. You had an important tribal leader that died down there at the end of last year, which basically has left a vacuum there, has made that whole area a lot more vulnerable since his death. I think, as I say, life goes on in Kabul. It's made no big immediate difference here. This is something that grabbed international headlines, was important, as I say, from a psychological blow standpoint, but it's been what anyone living here for the past few years has seen coming up.
And yep.
I don't think it's correct to sort of say that it's anything unexpected this year.
Understood. We're simply trying to learn from what we saw last week. John Aquila, perhaps you've been following it if from a distance. What's your sense of how Afghan troops, after these years of training and support from NATO and Americans, how they performed and the role of Big Daddy NATO air power last week?
Well, the Afghan National Army fights very well, as do all the ISAF forces. When you look at the what we call exchange ratios, the casualties we suffer to the ones that the Taliban do, it's somewhere between 75 and 100 to 1 in terms of killed in action. The problem, of course, is that we live in an age when every shot is a shot heard around the world. That's why a small-scale suicide attack or an ambush makes world news and can indeed make things appear to be far worse than they are. So I think Joanna makes a good point. Life goes on there, and we're still talking about something that is with really a quarter of the troops that we have in Iraq, the situation is at least four times better than it is over there. Now, that's relative, not absolute, but life does go on.
I want to get a sense of Afghan President Hamid Karzai was just a couple of weeks ago now, as this was heating up, threatening to actually send Afghan troops into neighboring Pakistan to go after Taliban militants and their supporters there. He's been criticized since for that, including by Condoleezza Rice, who said she thinks it would not be wise. But here he is calling out rebel supporters in Pakistan.
When they cross the territory from Pakistan to come and kill Afghans and to kill coalition troops, it exactly gives us the right to go back and do the same. Therefore, Baitullah Masood should know that we will go after him now and hit him in his house. Fazlullah should know the same, that we will go after him and hit him in his house. And he's in his bases. And the other fellow, Mullah Omar of Pakistan, should know the same. This is a two-way road in this case. And Afghans are good in the two-way road journey. We will complete this journey, and we will get them, and we will defeat them, and we will avenge all that they have done in Afghanistan for the past so many years.
Hamid Karzai, Afghan president, very hot under the collar right there. Condoleezza Rice saying in the last 24 hours it wouldn't be wise for Afghan troops to go over the border into Pakistan, but artillery barrage has gone on there. Let's take a call from Ontario, Canada. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
If I could make a few quick points. I have a cousin in the Princess Pat's, the Canadian, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry.
Mm-hmm.
The frustration in Canada with NATO is at the boiling point. We're sick to death of various countries who either won't send troops or send them and then they're off playing soccer somewhere because they're not allowed anywhere near the line of fire. As President Bush pointed out a few months ago, Canadians, along with the Americans, the Canadians are doing what's called the heavy lifting. In fact, we, given the number of troops there, we have more casualties than anybody else because we're constantly on the front line. As far as the prison escape, the Canadian top brass have been begging the people in Kandahar to strengthen that prison for months and months and months, and we're absolutely ignored. As far as I don't care what Condoleezza Rice says, personally, when my cousin is at risk, I think go in and wipe out those cadres that are being sheltered in Pakistan, and the sooner the better. But NATO had better get its act together because it's totally unfair that only certain countries are, as I say, doing the heavy lifting, suffering the terrible...
The casualties. Yep, Catherine, we've got it, and I can imagine any number of Americans resonating with that. We've got more from Canada here. Let's go to Windsor, Canada, and Todd. Todd, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to follow up on the fellow Canadian who spoke recently. There are two points. First of all, the reason Canada is in on this is very much for the same reason that you saw the situation in Vietnam. It's basically to stimulate the military-industrial complex. Canada has now announced a budget, military budget of $460 billion over the next 20 years.
But surely something has to happen in Afghanistan, Todd. I mean, they're trying to bring some stability and order there. Isn't that worthwhile?
Yes, they are, and they're also trying to sell as many American arms to Canada as they can, the defense industry. And we're paying a high price in blood and in treasury.
Yeah, there's skepticism from Canada. Todd, we've got it. Let me get one more here from across the border from you, a ways over in Buffalo, New York. Robert, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. One person addressed my question, but I do have a comment. While we don't seem to work so well with other troops that are actually integrated, I'm wondering if, not only wondering, my reading tells me it's we're so technically superior, we really can't work on the field with anybody but the Brits, plus we don't want to give away our security stuff.
I mean, you're talking about American troops, what, even Canadians? You're saying they're not technically advanced enough to fight alongside American troops, or Afghans, for that matter?
I know the British and the Americans can do that, and possibly the Canadians, but we're not having coordination with all these other troops. That's why, as the previous caller said, we're doing the heavy lifting. The American and Brits, and to some extent the Canadians, but as far as our technological, all that communication and all that war stuff during this really several years ago, I mean, there's no other country that can really get into that, you know, work with us on that. Plus,
yeah,
we have security issues.
Yeah, Robert, we've got it. Let me bring another voice into this conversation, and then Joanna and John Arquilla, I want to get your response, but first, joining us from London is Tariq Ali, British Pakistani, historian, political campaigner, novelist. He's editor of the New Left Review. Had a big piece there in the current issue called Afghanistan, Mirage of the Good War. Tariq Ali, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi there.
You haven't been in Afghanistan, so how do you know it's the mirage of a good war?
Well, I've been to Peshawar in Pakistan, which is packed with Afghans of every variety. And one gets a fairly good idea of what's going on. And, of course, if you look at the British press, conservative newspapers like the Sunday Times, as well as liberal newspapers like the Guardian, their correspondents are sending in fairly horrendous information. And leading writers now are calling for a withdrawal from Afghanistan as soon as possible.
But this has been seen, as you indicate, as a good and necessary war. We saw what happened when Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were sort of just untrammeled in Afghanistan. That wasn't too good.
That wasn't too good, but what is happening now has essentially revived not only the Taliban, but has won them enormous support because of large-scale bombings and deaths of civilians. This is a part of the world where the culture of revenge is very strong. If you kill civilians on both sides of the Pak-Afghan border, as has been happening, it makes the situation worse, not better. There has to be an exit strategy, and the West has to go public and say what are its aims in Afghanistan. I mean, recently, the Secretary General of NATO told the Brookings Institute in Washington that our aim is to have bases there in perpetuity. because this is a strategically important country on the border with China. This created mayhem in that part of the world. There were demonstrations in Kabul and other cities, citizens coming out saying we don't want Western or NATO or U.S. bases here in perpetuity. Karzai is becoming more and more popular, even in Kabul, where the bulk of his support lies, and in Kandahar. And it's chaotic, the situation. And this talk of extending the war to Pakistan, I mean, Condi Rice is absolutely right on that. It would be a total provocation and would make things worse, not better. Essentially, what has to be determined is there an exit strategy? What is the best way to get out? Which are the neighboring countries one can involve in stabilizing the situation? And I think the countries that have to be involved, in addition to Pakistan, are India, Russia, and Iran. These are three crucial regional players, and they have to be brought in to try and provide a stable base for that country and end a situation of war which is now carried on. You know, Afghanistan has been at war since 1979.
Yeah, of course, but it was hardly stable in the sense of not presenting a threat in the years before that time, but we'll look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Joanna Nathan, let me go to you first in Kabul in response to Tariq Ali. He's saying, you know, what's needed most here is an exit strategy. Others are saying what's needed most here is commitment, you know, demonstrated commitment to stay in and make this right. So what do you think? Which is it, Joanna?
I would like to get back to his conclusions in a minute, which I disagree with. I'll be quite brief about that. Mm-hmm. First, I would just like to say his article is just so riddled with factual inaccuracies that I cannot take it seriously. This is an ideological document. He does exactly what he accuses the right wing of, exaggerating things. He talks in here of Laura Bush using the Afghan women as a case to get America into the war. Then later in the article, he talks about numerous rapes of Afghan women by ISAF soldiers, which is simply untrue. He is doing exactly the same thing.
I mean, you look at what the women's organizations of Afghanistan are producing.
But Joanna, we take your point. You're not impressed with the factual basis. You call it ideological.
No, I would specifically like to challenge him on that point. Today I was so disturbed by this. I rang three human rights people here, long-time human rights people here, who could not name one case.
We take your rejection of that. We're unlikely to be able to get, you know, satisfaction right here, but we understand what you're saying.
On this.
Yeah. But do you think
can
it's...
Can he name one?
Tariq?
Rawa. Name Rawa, the Organization of Afghan Women, who have produced numerous documents.
I can't find anyone else here, including the Human Rights Commission, which can.
Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, sometimes the NGOs which are there do not have the same information as Afghan women's organizations. Add to that the other thing which I pointed out in my article, perhaps you're going to say this is exaggerated and deny it too, the number of brothels to service foreign soldiers in Afghanistan have shot up.
And I've been very strong in saying that foreigners need to behave appropriately.
Right, anyway. Okay. So you admit then that the situation...
I agree with many things in it, and I think it's disappointing. It's wrapped in so many inaccuracies because there are so many things going wrong here and so many important points.
The inaccuracies, and yeah, we will publish it and reply to you.
Let us step back for one second,
if we may.
John Arquilla, on the strategic front, what about it? Exit strategy or time for commitment here?
Oh, both, of course. We have to remain in the fight. I think it's very important for us to stop using the kind of force that kills civilians, Big Daddy air power, and have to rely more on basic good soldiering, and the network of small outposts that has worked well in Iraq will work just as well in Afghanistan. But the second point that I think Tariq raises is the idea of negotiations, which is also extremely important. Remember, in Anbar province, we turned all 23 tribes that were fighting us to work with us. And so we need to have a strategy designed to reach out to them, but I think also a larger regional strategy to bring all the parties in, and I would say including the Taliban themselves. And it seems to me that if we maintain and improve upon our military tactics, it's going to create the space for us to have negotiations and a regional settlement, because the Taliban when they do engage, and they are very spirited, and they understand that every fight is news around the world, they're still incurring enormous costs in every firefight. 55 dead in an ambush last night.
That's big.
That's going to increase their willingness to negotiate, and I think this blend of hard and soft power is the way ahead.
We're looking at the state of war and peace. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the state of war and peace in Afghanistan after a stretch of jailbreak and hot clashes in the south and the east. More killing, 55 rebels dead just yesterday. Let's take a call from Chester, Vermont, and Jack. You're on the air, Jack.
How are you today?
Okay, what do you see?
Well, I agree with that gentleman in England. He certainly is very prescient about what's going on. Having been over there for a couple of years, I can tell you that right now, with the opium trade, which is financing the Taliban, that's one, and two, there are a million teenagers across the border in Pakistan waiting to take up arms to come across the border.
When were you there? What were you doing there, Jack?
We're in advisory capacity with the special forces. But let me just say this. This is a war in which if you're going to go, it'll be like Vietnam, which I was also there. You're talking about a half a million to a million troops on the ground, and nobody wants to put that kind of force on the ground, and it would be resented by the Afghanis. Those people over there have been at war. The British were there 25 years. I can see this thing. They're absolutely correct. The gentleman in England is, you better sit down and negotiate with these people, because this is going to end up as the American people are very slowly thinking about, you and I know what's happening in Afghanistan is going to happen. The same situation is happening in Iraq.
John Arquilli, well, Iraq, they say, is getting better, but you were in Afghanistan. Who would you negotiate with there?
Well, I think, as Tariq pointed out, there are a number of countries who need to be at the table, the Russians, the Indians, the Iranians, and the Pakistanis, of course. There's no problem, really, in getting representation for the Taliban. They have many interlocutors who would speak for them. And again, I want to couch this in careful terms. We continue the counterinsurgent fight as a means of encouraging a negotiated solution. Much as we kept fighting in Vietnam, we were at the Paris peace table at the same time we were in the rice paddies. So it seems to me you have to have both of those together. But this is something that Iraq has shown us over the past year. A willingness to negotiate can sometimes achieve very, very profound effects in the field.
Jack, you say you were there at advisory capacity, U.S. Special Forces. You point to the teenagers in Pakistan across the border that can flood in. Do you really think that something satisfactory can be negotiated, something put on paper that would achieve the security concerns and stability that the U.S. clearly has an interest in post-9/11?
Well, unless it's a mega strategic plan, as some people feel, to counter China, I don't see, with the terrain, the mountains, and the history of this country, and these people have been fighting, they have well financed, they have very fine fire, they have enough firepower to keep us there ad infinitum, indefinitely. They have enormous capability, they're very skilled at what they do, and they can field a large, large force in time. The longer this goes on, the stronger they're going to get.
Jack, thanks for your call. Joanna Nathan in Kabul, what about fighting on the one hand and talking on the other? Is that something that you hear NATO officials in Kabul talking about? Would the Kabul government, the Afghan government, support that?
What we're talking about here, we're getting all the neighbors involved and somehow, international forces just being able to leave is nice, but it's just not possible. I mean, it's not even hypothetical. We've seen what happened with exactly this model of disengagement in the 1990s. The Americans just left Afghanistan. The neighbors were then all, there was the 6+2 meetings, which involved all the neighbors. All the neighbors came, sat at the meetings, yes, this is terrible, we will not fuel the war, and then went outside and immediately fueled the war, continued throughout. This is 30 years of war in which all the neighbors have interfered. You know, this has been driven by the neighbors. This is, Afghanistan's been used as their fighting zone. So I think it's a pipe dream today to say we just leave it to the neighbors. So, We've seen what happened before.
Right,
and for the Taliban coming.
Right. I don't think John Aquila is suggesting quite that. But what do you suggest?
No,
if 80,000 troops or so, whatever's there now, is not enough, if NATO at all are not going to put in 400,000, is a number that's been tossed around here, if you can't get there from here with this troop level, what should happen?
Well, I think what we haven't always talked about today is fighting. And I don't think anyone suggests we're going to shoot the last Talib and be able to leave here. All the fighting I think of as the boy with his finger in the dam. All that's doing is sort of stopping the leaks. And behind that, there's got to be a whole reconstruction job going on. That's what we've got to be emphasizing, is building up local security forces, building up the local government. You know, at the moment, there's just so much, corruption and disillusionment here. We've got to ensure these are institutions, worth fighting for, and that the population feels some buy-in. There was an enormous excitement in here back in 2004 with the presidential elections. People queued for miles. There was enormous excitement, and you just feel how that's gone down ever since. That we failed to. Well, I think we built up expectations too high.
How can that be turned around, Joanna?
Some of them.
How could that be turned around? If reconstruction is most important, how do you do it if there's corruption, disillusion, and a finger in the dam? How?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, the troops are there merely to hold it while we build up. So the emphasis has got to be on building institutions. And at the top of the list, I think we've got to put police and judiciary. And too often, during these past 7 years, we talk about doing this, and then we run off and pay a warlord or do some quick fix, hire some police, give them 2 weeks training and send them back out there in a uniform. That this is a long-term job. I think the other thing, of course, that's internally. The other thing that's got to be emphasized is changing Pakistan's, equations in the region. They've got to believe there is an international commitment here. If they're not, to just see that they must interfere, because otherwise when the foreigners leave, they'll be left with the mess. That we've got to stop pumping all our money through the Pakistan military and try and start working there with the Pakistan government, the new elected civilian government. That these are not the neighbours anyone would choose, but ultimately these are the neighbours we're stuck with. But it will involve international engagement to do this, to change the regional equations.
Let me put it to you, Tariq Ali in London. Joanna Nathan saying basically buck up. There's a job that has to be done here. Commit the resources, work with the Afghans, work with the Pakistanis, but don't cut and run. We saw what happened in the 90s when it was left to the neighbours.
Well, I mean, it's no longer in the hands of the neighbors. It's been in the hands of the Western powers, former colonial powers, for several years, and they've made a very big mess of it. And there's no good Joanna Nathan talking in a very idealistic way, like some of the better breed of old colonial administrators who used to run South Asia. I mean, it's the hearing Westerners talk about Afghanistan, they never ask themselves what they're really doing there and why they're there, and does the population want them there? And it's perfectly obvious, as your special forces gent pointed out, that they're not wanted there. And in order to impose their will on the country, you will need 500,000 troops, and you can then wipe out half the population of the country and occupy parts of Pakistan as well. Where is that going to get you?
That's the
question, which is why the only serious solution is a exit strategy for NATO, and I'm not in favor of handing over Afghanistan essentially to the Pakistani military intelligence, as was done the last time, which is why I argue for a regional solution, which includes the Taliban, which includes some of their supporters in Pakistan, includes the Pakistan government, but also brings in India, Iran, and Russia to the table, because these are big players in that country, that these people sit down with all the groups, form a national government, agree to fund the country with this national government for the next 10 years, and then we see what happens. This solution of finding puppet rulers who are backed essentially and kept in power by NATO armies and hoping for the best isn't going to work.
Let's look at that. John Aquila, I'll come to you. Let me get a call first from Ed in Nashville, Tennessee. Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Pretty well.
Take my call.
Yeah.
Yeah, quick question. I was wondering if negotiations would expedite some sort of end to all this, and is there an exit? I feel that an exit strategy is in order, and the Canadian caller touched on a very important fact that was sort of glossed over. Mm. We're in a capitalist society here in the United States. We have a huge war industry. I was a part of that in the Outer Belt in D.C., and lots of money is being made. Lots of money is being made in Iraq, and there's a potential for lots of money to be made in Afghanistan as well.
$160 billion plus the House was voting for last week, Ed. So, yes, it's expensive, and, of course, I guess that means people are making money, but people want the right solution here as well. Ed, thanks for your call. John Arquilla, give us a sense. You say, you know, fight for leverage, but also negotiate. Do the players that Tariq Ali in London is describing, in your view, have an interest in stability here? If you get Russia, Iran, India, the Taliban involved, do they have an interest in any kind of outcome that would be satisfactory to the whole region and to the United States?
Well, I think there's a real consonance of interest here on all their part, and to some extent it's in getting the Americans out. You know, this is a two centuries later version of the great game that was played long ago, in which the Russians were very uncomfortable with British influence in Afghanistan. And it seems to me that a regional negotiation and a more local negotiation with the Taliban fighters and sympathizers is one that would lead to stability in the country and our exit. And that would make the Iranians and the Russians and perhaps even the Pakistanis breathe a sigh of relief. I think our war aim right now should simply be a secure Pakistan in which violence levels are perhaps not entirely gone, but at acceptable levels. And I think an intervention into the Haven and Waziristan would only raise violence and perhaps even destabilize Pakistan. So the best we can do is remain on the strategic defensive, fighting the Taliban that come across the border, and we do that very, very well, we and our allies, at a tactical level. What we haven't done is have a diplomatic strategy to go with this, and I'm suggesting that if we add that, there is a way out, there is a way ahead for a secure and much more peaceful Afghanistan.
Let me ask you about that piece by piece. First, with Iran, the United States and Iran already in a very volatile relationship. If Afghanistan would then come more into Iran's orbit, doesn't that just give Iran more strategic depth as an opponent in the region?
Well, they're a tiny regional state, and you know, if you look at the case of Iraq, for example, I think Iran has actually been a force more for stability than unrest in Iraq. They've encouraged the Shia to remain peaceful as democratization develops, and they've done a lot of economic rebuilding, and one, I think, could count on them to do similar things in Afghanistan. This is, after all, their neighborhood. So I'm a little less troubled, and I don't think it upsets the power politics of the world to give the Iranians a major seat at the table here.
What about the Taliban itself? Would you imagine it reverting to the strict Islamic fundamentalist code and once again playing host to international terrorists, even Al-Qaeda?
Well, I think since their makeover, they've gotten a lot smarter about media, and they know they had a tremendous image problem. They were probably the least sympathetic regime in the world late in 2001. So I think it would be hard for them to go back to that. And also this regional solution that Tariq talks about is one that would not simply sign the paper and go away. There would be a watchful eye kept. Let's also remember that we used to do business with the Taliban themselves before 9/11, and these are practical, in some respects, practical people. In fact, they were even negotiating with us about handing over bin Laden. How seriously is a subject of debate, but they were willing to talk about that. And just as a small last point, about half the Taliban hate al-Qaeda's guts. I think we could get a twofer here. We might solve the Afghan problem, and in the course of this negotiation, maybe we could get some of the Talibs to turn on al-Qaeda and hand a lot of them over, perhaps even the most senior leaders.
Let's get one more call here from Richmond, Indiana. Jawad, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a quick point and also ask a question, if that's possible. My comment has to do with I see a clear choice for the U.S., whether to spend its resources, the resources that it has, in helping Afghan people to stand on its own feet or to spend that money in hiring more contractors and buying more bullets and sending soldiers and so on, which I think it is better in the benefit of both Afghan and American people if they spend, you know, at least half of that money in helping the people there so that they can help themselves.
Jawad, our time is short. They're already spending money on reconstruction. Are you saying troops out and more aid money in? Is that your solution?
Well, I'm saying that the problems are growing by month, and they have to spend more and more money in military part of the mission, and so the part of the money that they are spending in the reconstruction, you know, it's being wasted mostly.
Yeah. Jawad, our time is trickling down here. Joanna Nathan, you're in Kabul. Last word goes to you. We're hearing some big solutions put on the table here involving negotiation and neighbors. What do you think? Is that what it's going to come to, whether or not you think that's the wisest way?
I think the thing I'd really like to emphasize in the last couple of seconds left is saying that the population want us here. I'm not saying...
Come off it. How dare you speak like that?
She's there, Mr. Ali. You're not. Joanna, please go ahead.
The population are more scared of if we go. I'm not saying they want us here forever. I don't think they like us. But the main thing they would like to do is be left alone. But at the moment, at this point in time, they are more scared what will happen if we leave than if we stay.
We're going to leave it right there today. No clear answer, but it's not meant to be easy. A lot of interesting thinking, though, going on, and you hear the back and forth. Joanna Nathan in Kabul with the International Crisis Group, thank you very much for being with us. John Arquilla in Monterey, California, at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. John, it's always good to have you. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Tariq Ali in London, the New Left Review. Tariq Ali, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.